and from the influences of the sun, clocks, or any other devices that would mark time for them. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by Barbara Boltz with help from Dolores Schroeder. For A Moment of Science, I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, number one Alabama's Rolando McClain is the winner of the Butkus Award as college football's top linebacker. He was presented the award this morning in a surprise visit by Dick Butkus, a Hall of Fame linebacker and the award's namesake. The junior is the leader of the nation's top-scoring defense and helped guide the Crimson Tide to a Southeastern Conference championship and a spot in the BCS national title game against number two, Texas. Bears head coach Lovie Smith will not comment on a Chicago Sun-Times report that fired Notre Dame coach Charlie Weiss would be interested in becoming Chicago's offensive coordinator. Weiss had that job with the New England Patriots and helped develop Tom Brady into one of the game's top quarterbacks. Indiana Pacers forward Danny Granger, the team's leading scorer, will be out for at least 4 weeks with a foot injury. The Pacers say Granger will not need surgery and has started rehabilitation. The struggling Chicago Bulls host the NBA's worst team tonight. The New Jersey Nets lost their first 18 games of the season and are 1-19 overall. The Bulls have dropped 7 of their last 8. And in college hoops, Illinois plays at home tonight against Vanderbilt. The Illini are 6-2 and have won 9 straight non-conference games at Assembly Hall.
Today's broadcast is funded in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency.
Create the ultimate smart car. On your way home today, take All Things Considered along for the ride. Keeping up with the news of the day might seem like one big detour, but don't worry, we know all the back roads. From Chengdu to Chillicothe, from Karachi to Kalamazoo, from Washington to Wasilla. All Things Considered from NPR News, your shortcut to the world.
Today from 4 to 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
It's 2:42. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. You can find some of the most amazing coral reefs in this hemisphere in the waters off the island of Cuba. But American scientists have rarely had a chance to see them because of political tensions between the U.S. and Cuba. A partnership now for marine research is trying to change that. Reporter Nick Miroff joined a team of scientists from both countries to check out one of Cuba's most remote places.
50 miles south of central Cuba, hundreds of tiny islands stretch into the Caribbean, ringed with narrow beaches and thick stands of red mangrove. When Christopher Columbus arrived here, he named the area Los Jardines de la Reina, the Queen's Gardens. 5 centuries later, there isn't a single town or road or permanent human presence. Only a few hundred divers visit each year, and the gardens are still here, underwater. The Cuban government banned fishing over a 386-square-mile section of these islands in 1997, creating what scientists say is the Caribbean's largest marine reserve. But there's been little research done since. When U.S. scientist David Guggenheim of the Ocean Foundation came up from his first dive and took off his mask, he looked stunned.
It's amazing. It's sort of like Jurassic Park. Scientists are seeing these species they never expected to see in their life because they were extinct. Well, these fish aren't extinct, but they might as well be for most of us. So I feel very lucky to see them. Oh, look at the shark right at the surface here.
Guggenheim had come to the area on a converted lobster boat with a Cuban marine biologist and 2 U.S. colleagues. Dropping below the surface into underwater canyons of black coral and giant sea fans, Guggenheim encountered species he'd only seen in photographs, like the nearly extinct Nassau grouper. For him and other scientists, the area is like a large-scale experiment. Take out the fishermen, pollution, and coral-killing fertilizer runoff, and you get huge fish, along with sharks, sea turtles, and saltwater crocodiles. As these species flourish, some will leave the reserve, helping repopulate other areas where their numbers are depleted.
Fish are not just crops that grow in the sea for us to harvest. It doesn't work that way. Fish have important jobs to do, and when we remove them in numbers, they can't do those jobs. And we've seen time and time again ecosystems collapse, especially coral reef ecosystems, when we upset that balance.
Look at this guy.
One obvious sign of a healthy balance is the sharks. Elsewhere in the region, their numbers have declined 90% or more. But in these royal blue waters, they're everywhere, circling our boat and passing inches from the camera of underwater photographer Kip Evans.
Caribbean ray sharks are not exactly the lap cats of the sea.
No, they're a little more aggressive. In fact,
sure
watch
are.
Your foot.
If I could get my fin off, I'd get out right now.
Evans was glad to see the toothy predators up close, even if their presence doesn't make for a relaxing dive.
To even see a shark in some places is a big deal these days, and to come to this area and dive with dozens of sharks is truly something special. I haven't seen big fish on a Caribbean reef in 10 years, 10 or 15 years now.
Evans is working on a documentary about places around the world where marine ecosystems remain relatively intact.
It's kind of disheartening when you go back to your favorite dive spot and it's changed and the corals are dead and the fish are gone. Now I've spent my time kind of looking for those special spots that are still pristine or they still have enough animal life in them, marine life in them, that I can make some beautiful images.
Drifting through narrow channels between the islands in a small skiff, we see great blue heron, pink spoonbills, and another reason the reefs appear so healthy. Dense green thickets of mangrove spill from the shoreline. The water is so clear you can dive among their tangled roots, where reef fish hide for protection.
There's as much going on here as there is on the reef. You see a lot of the same fish here that you see on the reef. In fact, a lot of them are born and raised here and then move out to the reef as adults.
For years, Guggenheim has been working to bring together American scientists and their counterparts in Cuba and Mexico. The three countries are now drafting a regional protection plan. Cuban biologist Fabian Pina hopes that'll lead to more joint research with Americans.
There are many, many resources that we shared. We are very, very close in distance, and we share the sharks, we share the snappers, groupers, corals, larvae, waters. We share many things, and we need to work together to preserve those things.
Standing on the beaches of these uninhabited islands, it's hard to imagine them remaining this way for long. With a new push in Congress to end U.S. travel restrictions to Cuba, ocean advocate Sherry Sant Plummer said she worries what will happen.
With having more visitors, there's more risk. Right now, it is so far away from Havana and so inaccessible by a lot of tourists, especially in the United States, and a lot of fishermen. The sharks are so friendly, they could be easily fished out.
On the last night on the boat, the group looked at underwater photos as a pair of small speakers played the only music for miles around. Guggenheim had dived at sundown through huge, glowing formations of elkhorn coral, a species, he said, has died off in the Florida Keys.
It's really a time machine here in Cuba, and we've got another chance to look at these reefs the way they used to be. It's almost as if someone's telling us, okay, guys, you've got one more chance to get this right. Look around, see what it's supposed to look like, protect this, and use these lessons to protect everything else that you've screwed up over the years.
Guggenheim is now organizing a meeting this spring in Florida to finalize the agreement between American, Cuban, and Mexican marine researchers. It'll be the first time the scientists come together in the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Nick Miroff.
It's 2:49. Congress is haggling over a climate bill that includes a carbon cap and trade system. In many ways, it's similar to the one the European Union put in place several years ago. Liam Moriarty looks at what the European experience has been and what lessons it might hold for the U.S.
Slashing greenhouse gas emissions is hard. Our economy is powered mostly by fossil fuels. Switching to clean fuels will be disruptive and expensive, at least to start with. So how do we get from here to there? The approach that's proving most popular is what's called cap and trade. It works like this. First, there's the cap.
We're going to put an absolute limit on the quantity of carbon-based fuels that we're going to burn. And we're going to develop a system to make sure that we're not burning more fossil fuels than that.
Alan Derning heads the Sightline Institute, a sustainability-oriented think tank in Seattle. He explains that once you put the cap in place,
then we're going to let the market decide who exactly should burn the fossil fuels based on who has better opportunities to reduce their emissions.
That's the trade part. Companies get permits to put out a certain amount of greenhouse gases. Outfits that can cut their emissions more than they need to can sell their unused pollution permits to companies that can't. The cap gets ratcheted down over time, so there are fewer permits out there to buy. Eventually, even the most polluting companies have to reduce their emissions as well. The goal is to wean ourselves off dirty fuels by making them more expensive, and that makes cleaner fuels more attractive. Europe was the first to do carbon cap and trade 4 years ago, and things got off to a rough start. They set the cap on emissions too high and way overestimated the number of permits or allowances that companies would need.
We have too many allowances, simple supply and demand. It means that the price of those allowances crashes. They don't have much value, and therefore the price went down to close to zero.
That's Vicky Pollard. She follows climate change negotiations for the European Commission. She says the whole system got knocked out of kilter. For the first 2 years, European carbon emissions actually went up. After the collapse of phase one, big changes were made. The next phase of the trading system has a tighter cap, more stringent reporting requirements, and enforcement with teeth. Today, Europe's on track to meet its current emissions target. But environmentalists such as Sanjeev Kumar with the World Wildlife Fund in Brussels say those targets are still driven more by politics than by science.
We have a cap that's very weak, i.e. that means that it doesn't actually mean that we're going to achieve the levels of decarbonization that we need within a timescale.
Leading climate scientists say we have to cut greenhouse gas emissions to 80% below 1990 levels by the middle of this century to avoid catastrophic climate change. Business still has concerns about the EU cap-and-trade scheme. Volker Franz is with Business Europe, sort of the European version of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He says companies worry about the additional cost of carbon emissions putting them at a competitive disadvantage.
If you produce 1 ton of steel, you emit roughly 1 ton of CO2. So any ton of steel produced in the EU is right now some $17 more expensive than outside the European Union, and that makes a difference.
But Franz says European businesses accept the need to take prompt action on climate change and are on board with the stricter cap-and-trade rules coming over the next few years. Americans have watched Europe struggle with carbon cap-and-trade. The Sightline Institute's Alan Derning says we can benefit from Europe's willingness to break new ground.
It was a big advance when they started it because nothing like it had ever been done. But it's not the be-all and end-all. And in fact, the United States now has an opportunity to learn from their mistakes and leapfrog ahead to a much better climate policy.
Derning says an American cap-and-trade system could avoid the costly stumbles that have hampered Europe's carbon reduction efforts. For the Environment Report, I'm Liam Moriarty.
There have been far fewer toys recalled this year because of lead contamination than in past years. But Rebecca Williams reports, even with a tough new federal law limiting lead, toys with illegal levels of lead remain on store shelves.
So far, this year, more than 1 million toys and kids' products have been recalled because they contain high levels of lead. That's actually a big drop from the past 2 years. The toy industry, government officials, and even environmental groups all say this holiday season is safer.
This is all due to parent and consumer demands and outrage over what's happened in the past.
That's Mike Schreiberg. He's with the Ecology Center. Parents were outraged because lead exposure can cause loss of IQ points, brain damage, and even death. The American Academy of Pediatrics says there is no safe level of lead exposure. But Schreiberg says there's a little good news here. Most toy companies and retailers have heard parents' demands.
Companies are trying to prove their safety to customers. And so many of them have announced voluntary standards above federal laws. They actually are being more motivated to do the testing and to show that their products are safer. And that's where we're seeing some of the improvement.
Both Walmart and Toys R Us responded by email to questions from the Environment Report. Both retailers say they are thoroughly testing toys and, in some cases, hold their suppliers to higher standards than the federal law. But Mike Schreiberg says the news is not all good.
We're still finding about 3% of all the toys that we tested actually exceed recall levels, which means that they have lead above a level deemed to be safe by federal laws.
The government's Consumer Product Safety Commission is in charge of making sure toys are safe. 3 billion toys are sold in the U.S. each year. The federal government does not test every kind of toy. Nichelle Fleming is with the commission. She says the commission has a team of people testing toys, and inspectors do random toy checks at ports and retail stores. But she says the commission also relies on toy makers, advocacy groups, and even parents to report problems with toys, including lead contamination.
Unfortunately, there's no real way I can tell shoppers, you know, to know how to look out for or avoid. I think the best way for shoppers to know that is to really be in the loop with the commission, to be a part of getting our recall announcements directly so that you don't have to question or wonder, you know, which product is affected.
The Toy Industry Association says it's not just the government's job to make sure toys are safe. It says the industry has undertaken an unprecedented level of inspections and re-inspections to keep lead out of toys. But some shoppers are not getting a clear message about lead in toys. Like these people we caught up with at a Target store.
When you've got little kids that say that, you know, I want this or I want that, and they see it on TV or they see it in the store, it's kind of hard to balance that against whether something has lead or not.
Usually they've been told, haven't they?
I don't know. Maybe they haven't.
Well, I probably watch for it just because I know you're supposed to, but I don't know the guidelines or the limits or anything. I really don't.
So clearly, not everybody knows what to look for when they're shopping. Mike Schreiberg with the Ecology Center says it really shouldn't be this hard.
Part of our message as parents is your lives are already complicated. The fact that our federal chemical regulatory system is completely failing means that really you almost have to be a chemist to do your shopping. And that shouldn't be.
Schreiberg says when it comes to lead, you can be a little more confident this holiday season. But he says there's still no guarantee that all toys will be lead-free. He says you should avoid children's metal jewelry and toys from vending machines. He says simpler toys, like unpainted wood toys, tend to be the safest choices. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Earth and sky.
There are pathways out of the dilemma that we've got ourselves into. With some clear thinking, with some good structure and international agreement, we can actually shape a different energy future.
You're listening to David Hone, climate change advisor for Shell. He's talking about the dilemma of rising global demand for energy while fossil fuel burning is known to be one of the elements causing climate change. He said climate change is a key issue for Shell, and he spoke of world leaders gathering in Copenhagen in December 2009 with the goal of reaching a new global climate treaty.
Well, I think in relation to where we're going on the climate change discussions leading to Copenhagen, I think the key message is don't forget the market.
Hone is hoping for guidelines for an effective system for global trading of carbon emissions.
The Kyoto Protocol, which was negotiated back in 1997, was built on the basis of a global carbon market as one of its long-term goals. I think clearly the world's going to change, but I think let's not forget the market foundations that it's built on and the fact that the market can deliver some very substantial changes if directed in the right way.
These changes to how energy is produced, said Hone, include renewable energy.